free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear.
Good morning from KPFK News. I'm Hal Lohr, and this is your morning update. Calmer winds overnight and into Sunday morning gave firefighters a chance to gain some ground on the Palisades and Eaton fires before expected high winds return Sunday night, with a red flag warning extended into the middle of the week. At least 16 people now have died in the Eaton and Palisades fire, according to the latest update from the County of Los Angeles Medical Examiners. A death toll is expected to rise as investigators comb through the devastated neighborhoods. Overwhelmed with an outpouring of generosity, the Los Angeles Fire Department has asked Good Samaritans to please donate goods to centralized donation centers rather than individual fire stations. A list of some approved locations and what they need is available online. With thousands of evacuees expected to return to devastated neighborhoods this week, officials have offered tips on how people can stay safe when they go home to what may still be dangerous conditions, even if the fire is gone from the area. See those tips at CalFire.com. Both the Eaton and Palisades fire continue to threaten thousands of people on multiple fronts. See the most recent updates on the evacuation zones at cityofla.com. Next up, we have Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman starting at 10 o'clock. And for more information on the fires, you can go to watchduty.com. We will have a link for them at kpfk.org. And this has been your morning update.
Thank you for tuning in to your community radio station during this very difficult time for our great city of Los Angeles. Please know that KPFK is committed to keeping you both informed and safe. You can visit the station's website, kpfk.org, for trusted resources, timely updates, and essential information.
KPFK, Los Angeles.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm producer-director Melissa Figueroa, sitting in for Susie Weissman. Our hearts go out to everyone affected by the multiple wildfires that have ravaged the Los Angeles area over the past several days and continue to threaten new areas as Santa Ana winds surge anew in a bone-dry landscape. We'll share some important local resources for fire survivors after the music break. This week, we dig into the archives to bring you highlights from Susie's past interviews with perhaps the clearest, most prescient writer on wildfires in California, Mike Davis. It's been nearly 30 years since Mike Davis published his infamous essay, The Case for Letting Malibu Burn, in 1996, a starkly honest look at the fire-dependent geography of LA's coastal communities and the tragedies that result from unchecked real estate development in high fire hazard areas. At the time of its publication, Mike Davis faced an enormous amount of backlash and criticism from the mainstream media and city boosters. But in the three decades since, especially with climate change driving more intense and more destructive fires in California, reality seems to have not only confirmed his insights, but perhaps even gone beyond his predictions, with this unprecedented January urban firestorm that Mike, who passed away in 2022, may not even have imagined. We begin with Susie's interview with Mike in 2018, during the last big wildfire in Malibu, the Woolsey Fire. At the time, Paradise was also burning in Northern California in the Camp Fire, which, until this week, was the most destructive wildfire in the state's history in terms of structural damage and homes lost. Mike compares and contrasts this tale of two fires and two communities with very different class characteristics, much like Pacific Palisades and Altadena. Then, we go to an interview from 2021 with Mike talks specifically about the implications of climate change for wildfires and their destructive power in the wildland-urban interface, and how the solution to this urgent problem and preventing further tragedy requires a radical decolonizing of the land, our cities, and ourselves. All this when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome back to Beneath the Surface. I'm producer-director Melissa Figueroa, sitting in for Susie Weissman. Susie is still on the road this week, but stay tuned. We will bring you a new show next week as we process the enormous tragedy unfolding in front of us now in the Los Angeles area as communities continue to burn and others being evacuated or under threat. Our hearts go out to everyone affected by these fires, the 16 confirmed casualties who lost their lives in the Palisades and Eaton fires, the survivors who got out with their lives, all who have lost their homes, first responders from all over the world who have come to help, and the incarcerated firefighters putting their lives on the line for little to no pay in highly exploitative conditions. But before we bring you the words of Mike Davis on California wildfires past, present, and future, we'd like to take a few minutes to share important information on local mutual aid resources for fire survivors, evacuees, and anyone in the area who would like to pitch in and help. If you are evacuated and seeking shelter or looking for a place to stay if you have lost your home, you can visit 211LA.org for information on shelters and short-term rentals. The LA Recorder's Office has also set up a hotline for LA County residents directly impacted by the fires who have lost property and vital records. Call 1-800-201-8999 and select option 1, then option 2, to request free certified copies of any vital records that you may have lost in the fire. There are two excellent mutual aid websites that have been set up with extensive directories of resources for fire survivors, as well as donation and volunteer opportunities for anyone in the area wanting to help. The Los Angeles Mutual Aid Network at mutualaidla.org has a spreadsheet published on their website where you can look up resources and volunteer opportunities at a location near you. Also, the website fireaid.info has a very useful interactive map labeled with the type of resource available, whether it's free food, shelter, pet boarding and care, and more. Again, that's mutualaidla.org and fireaid.info or info. For resources specific to the Altadena, Pasadena area and Eaton Fire survivors, Octavia's Bookshelf at 1353 North Hill Avenue in Pasadena has become a mutual aid pit stop with food and supplies and is taking donations for specific items for residents of historic Black Altadena affected by the fire. That's Octavia's Bookshelf at 1353 North Hill Avenue in Pasadena. You can also make monetary donations to Friends Indeed Pass. That's Friends, INDEEDPAS .org to help those affected in Altadena and Pasadena. Seven LA County Public Libraries are hosting in-person enrollment for FEMA claims today, Sunday, January 12th, and tomorrow, Monday, January 13th, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. The seven libraries are La Crescenta Library at 2809 Foothill Boulevard in La Crescenta, La Cañada Flint Ridge Library at 4545 North Oakwood Avenue in La Cañada Flint Ridge, West Hollywood Library at 625 North San Vicente Boulevard, San Fernando Library at 217 North McClay Avenue in San Fernando, Live Oak Library at 22 West Live Oak Avenue in Arcadia, Temple City Library at 5939 Golden West Avenue in Temple City, and the San Gabriel Library at 500 South Del Mar Avenue in San Gabriel. FEMA is, of course, notorious for denying aid to disaster survivors across the country. But from my perspective, as someone who has been in multiple communities that have gone through wildfire disasters, it is important to know your rights as a survivor in a federal or disaster area and to file a claim and advocate for yourself and your families and communities. I know that strong networks have arisen on the Gulf Coast to pressure FEMA to do more for disaster survivors. And the more ways we can raise our voices collectively and demand help and action from government agencies, the better to improve the paradigm of recovery for the future. Because with climate change, unfortunately, there will be more disasters, and more of our communities will be on the front lines. With all that said, now we turn to the words of Mike Davis. It's been nearly 30 years since Mike Davis published his infamous essay, The Case for Letting Malibu Burn, in 1996, a starkly honest look at the fire-dependent geography of LA's coastal communities and the tragedies that result from unchecked real estate development in high fire hazard areas. At the time of its publication, Mike Davis faced an enormous amount of backlash and criticism from the mainstream media and city boosters. But in the three decades since, especially with climate change driving more intense and more destructive fires in California, reality seems to have not only confirmed his insights, but perhaps even gone beyond his predictions, with this unprecedented January firestorm that Mike, who passed away in 2022, may not even have imagined. So we begin with Susie's interview with Mike in 2018 during the last big wildfire in Malibu, the Woolsey Fire. At the time, Paradise in Butte County, California, 500 miles north, was also burning in the Camp Fire, which until this week was the most destructive wildfire in the state's history in terms of structural damage and homes lost. Mike compares and contrasts this tale of two fires and two communities with very different class characteristics, much like Pacific Palisades and Altadena. Here's Susie with Mike Davis in 2018.
In 1996, Mike Davis was pilloried for publishing his article, The Case for Letting Malibu Burn, which caused consternation and derision. But 22 years later, he's been proved more than right. Mike's a former meat cutter and long-distance truck driver. He's taught urban theory, history, and writing, and was awarded the MacArthur Fellowship. You can Google him for all the rest of the books, but I'll mention Ecology of Fear, Late Victorian Holocaust, City of Quartz, and Prisoners for the American Dream. Mike, it's really great to have you here. Well, the subject is not so great. As of this recording, the Northern California's Camp Fire has consumed maybe 10,000 or more structures. And in Southern California, we have the Woolsey and Hill fires. And we also know that a few minutes before the Camp Fire and the Woolsey fires began, utility companies in both areas reported problems with electricity lines, which are going to be investigated. And I should just say finally that this fire has produced huge amount of people who are now unhoused and looking for shelter, climate refugees, if you will. And they are flooding into Chico and Oroville and other towns in the north. These are small towns, like 100,000 or less. And so to get so many thousands of people coming in is now really creating problems for an overwhelmed services. So with all of that, Mike, let's focus on the tale of two fires and contrasting both the Paradise and Malibu conflagrations. That's the place that we should start. How do you compare them?
Paradise has about 27,000 people. Malibu half that. But if you go to the U.S. Bureau of Census website, you discover they share one thing in common, which is they're basically geriatric communities with twice as many people over the age of 65, the California median, and half the number of people under the age of 6. Otherwise, it'd be hard to find two communities that are so different. In Paradise, the average home value is $200,000, which is about as affordable as you get in California these days. In Malibu, of course, the median home value is 10 times that. Mm. Malibu incomes are 4 to 5 times higher in median than those in Paradise. And Paradise has one really unusual distinction, which is a phenomenal number of disabled people. setting aside the elderly people, the people over the age of 65, fully a fifth of the population under 65 in Paradise is disabled. In other words, we get a picture of a community full of people who retired there because housing's cheap or been forced to leave the Bay Area or Valley towns because the unaffordability of housing, but also strikingly large number of people who live in rest homes or in some form disabled. And that's a very large group of people who are most vulnerable in the face of a fire and least able to evacuate. So the tale of two fires is really the tale of two Californias, one rich on the coast, the other working class in the Sierra foothills. On a larger scale, the people from Paradise join the immense number of people globally been made homeless or displaced or forced to immigrate because of environmental disasters, particularly because of drought. Shouldn't forget that drought has ravaged Central America over the last decade. Many of the people coming north toward the border from Central America are fleeing not only violence, but they're fleeing global warming, they're fleeing environmental disaster.
Right.
In an American historical context, you could say that the Dust Bowl is now being recapitulated as the Fire Bowl.
Wow. Let's move a little bit then into what you've started to talk about, too, because it's the new normal or the new climate situation, which is instead of being a Dust Bowl, even though we have drought, we have a Fire Bowl, we have hurricane bowls, too. And, Malibu, can you maybe talk about the two different fire ideologies? In other words, what's different?
Well, it's extremely important to make a distinction between, and I'm sorry for the cold-blooded term, but what you might call normal fires, that is fire frequencies that existed before global warming or even before urbanization, and then the intensification of traditional fire patterns by climate change, by epic drought and record extreme heats during the summer. And both Malibu and Paradise are in areas which burn at a very high natural or normal frequency. There have been, in my lifetime, since the great 1956 fire, there have been 10 major Malibu fires. But in the Sierra foothills, fires occur almost every decade. Paradise area has had 9 major fires this century. And back in the summer of 2008, parts of the city were evacuated twice in June and July because of encroaching fire. And at that time, since population had recently swollen, Butte County fire officials and planners realized they had a tremendous problem. With the greater population, the roads were clogged, people had a hard time getting out, and then, of course, this problem of immobile and disabled people who had to be moved. So in both cases, fire frequency, even without global warming, is very, very high. In fact, in the case of Malibu, you can find, I think, anywhere in the American West, a fire corridor that burns as frequently. But the second set of factors, and they apply not particularly to Malibu, but to what we've seen in Northern California especially, is that epic drought and the extreme heat during the summers, the extreme heat that even in a wet year sucks up soil moisture and dries plants, has intensified these normal fire patterns. Fires are larger, they spread faster, and we, of course, have seen in the 21st century now the 7 biggest fires in recorded history of California, the Mendocino fire, the Lark Complex, the Thomas fire, followed by the terrible mudslides, and the Santa Rosa fire, which scared the pants off Californians for good reason, because it's not a fire in the foothills of the forest. That's where the fire started, but it burnt right into developed parts of a California city and wiped out flatland neighborhoods with very little warning for the residents. Now, if you permit me to continue briefly with this, the reason it's important to make this distinction between natural fire frequency and the intensification that's due to climate change is that, particularly in the speeches of Governor Brown, but in other officials, you keep hearing this explanation that global warming is responsible for the fires, but California is leading the way in reducing carbon emissions. Mm. That's a non sequitur, and it's a way of avoiding or not addressing what is politically the most difficult problem of all, which is the fact that unregulated development in fire corridors and wildlands has immensely increased fire hazards. Fully half of the homes built in California in the last 20 years are at what fire scientists call the urban or suburban wildland interface, or within forests or mountains. So just like on the East Coast, where there's been this enormous building boom in first-class hurricane counties because people want to live at the beach, we put half our new houses in areas that have fire frequencies like those of Paradise or the Malibu Coast.
Mike, I'm really glad that you laid it out that way, but as you were speaking and thinking about these, what you call firestorms destroying towns, and that's kind of a new feature, even though we've seen historically quite large fires, as you mentioned. This really goes back to what you said more than 20 years ago in your Let Malibu Burn. It seems like your thesis is vindicated and really irrefutable that, you know, these super fires move so quickly and consume so much that I think your argument holds for today. And yet we're seeing that people are vowing to rebuild on the same, you know, plots of land. Is that something that it will only take policy to deal with? And let me just ask a further part of that question, because if you look at the map of the fire corridor, it's really a lot of California. So that does beg the question, what do you do with this population?
Well, I'm not sure that when you say I've been vindicated,
that's the wrong word.
Expression's a little odd, because Malibu fire is just a fact. Nowhere in California, maybe in the entire West Coast, burns as frequently. Now, when ordinary people build a house or buy a house, they either know their neighborhood well or they go out and investigate it thoroughly. Well, Malibu's neighborhood is fire. And there are probably people in Malibu today who've gone through three or four homes lost to fires. And when, you know, celebrities and movie stars, including people we all like Neil Young, lose their homes, on one hand, you feel sorry for anybody that's been dehoused by fire, but you also have to ask this kind of egregious, continuous violation of common sense that to rebuild where fire is inevitable. Now, a factor in this was after the big 2003 fire, Malibu Topanga fire, the city of Malibu launched a big effort to fireproof the area with brush clearance and roofs that weren't inflammable. And it created a false sense of security. Same thing happened here in Eastern San Diego County, which burned so badly in 2003-2007. People thought they were now secure. Developers created whole new communities in the backcountry with only one road in and out because they now said, well, we'll shelter in place like the Australians do. We'll have a safe center. And what the fires of the last year or 2 years have done is it's just incinerated these deceptions, or these, you know, self-dissections about safety. Just as in my childhood, everybody in California believed that fire breaks would protect us.
We thought that in Montana, too, by the way.
The what?
We also thought that in Montana with the fire breaks, and we're seeing gigantic fires there, too. but go on.
Yeah, I mean, you look at California from the air in the 1950s, and, you know, the mountains are just, they look like, it's got high enough, they look like freeways crossing the mountains. And, of course, we now know that once you have a firestorm, it can throw debris a quarter of a mile, maybe even a half a mile ahead of it, and it easily jumps interstate freeways. So that's no protection at all. I mean, in 2003, you know, the largest deployment of fire apparatus and firefighters in California history on Topanga Canyon Road is the fire approach from the direction of Malibu. And it just hopscotched right over the fire line. The only thing that saved it from burning into the Palisades was the fact that the wind reversed. San Diego in the 2007 fire was at the outskirts of Del Mar. And again, it wasn't a fire line that saved it. It was just a change in the wind. So one thing that has to happen is to destroy this false belief that there is some solution on an individual scale or through community preparedness plans to the problem of wildfire. There really isn't. You have to reduce the human footprint. And the truth is that there's lots of space for the development of housing. It's not that we've run out of space. It's that the private real estate market dictates the form of our cities, dictates where we live, forces us, ordinary people, further and further away from the coast. And we're in Malibu. You could say that a great burden of responsibility falls on the people who live there and continually use fire insurance to rebuild. Paradise, how can you blame people who don't have the money to live in California cities along the coast and find a wonderful refuge in the woods? But I believe by blaming climate change, though it's real, we're avoiding the really big problems about regulating development and the kind of pay-to-play politics that that involves, where even where you have reasonable, serious plans to control development, they're so often overridden by lobbyists and campaign money, and you end up making exemptions. I won't go on about this, but no, I can tell you about a case in Altadena that's a particularly outrageous example. There's a development in Altadena that everybody agreed shouldn't have been built. But our county government, which is the largest local government in North America and the most powerful, and the LA Times hasn't had a reporter on the county government beat for 30 years, so it operates in invisibility, basically bypassed all the usual approval environmental impact procedures and let it be developed. Now, you have to multiply that by several magnitudes across all of California, east of Escondido in San Diego County, the last remaining intact Spanish land grant ranch is about to be turned into a suburban community of 15 or 20,000 people. And this is all in the chaparral and the hills. It's all in the California's fire ecology. So as we'll see similarly in hurricane-affected coastal counties, what will come out of this? The learning curve tends to be negative. Fire also, particularly when it occurs in more affluent areas, leads to gentrification. Big fire in the Oakland-Berkeley Hills, or the fires in San Diego County, the rebuilding just produced bigger, more expensive homes, while the trailer parks and the homes of people who didn't have adequate fire insurance or the wealth, they were displaced. And it's a, you know, it's a crazy political economic system.
Exactly.
That so comprehensively ignores nature, ignores climate change, and continues to build where houses will inevitably burn.
It's also
in entire towns.
Yeah, I mean, as you're speaking, Mike Davis, I'm thinking, you know, that even the sort of smaller doable thing, which would be to have public utilities and, you know, nationalize or socialize, let's call it, Southern California Edison and PG&E, and force, you know, take those profits from the pockets and put it in investing in really good infrastructure. But that's not enough, from what you're saying. Development itself has to be.
We should mention something about the utilities. And again, just as in the cases of areas where very recent fires should have led to decisive measures in terms of evacuation and fire preparedness and didn't, what's happened to utility regulation over the last 20 years? Because the 2007, rather, San Diego fire was caused by fallen utility lines.
Right.
But why wasn't something done? Why wasn't there a hearing about this in the California legislature? Who oversees the Public Utility Commission these days? And now that the Democrats have a supermajority in Sacramento, all these issues fall at their feet.
Right, exactly. And so I can see that this is a much larger issue than just climate change, but it's forced by climate change. And it's all of a sudden, you know, it's also a housing crisis. It's a health crisis and it's a development crisis as well. Mike, in the last minutes, though, I want to talk about the convict firefighters. They've been highlighted even in, I think, today's LA Times, sort of, you know, really it's been a very positive program on the one hand to allow people to get this experience. But on the other hand, you know, as you will probably explain, they're paid a dollar or two an hour, or maybe it's a day. Will you talk a little bit about who's fighting these fires?
Well, I mean, much of the burden of firefighting in California, particularly because of the failure of taxpayers to enlarge the state and county fire services, falls on inmates. Sheriff's inmates, but above all, prison inmates, Department of Corrections. And they face extreme dangers every day fighting these fires. And I've been circulating a proposal hoping to find somebody who has the bully pulpit to really carry it forward, that we should petition Governor to reward these unsung heroes by reducing their sentences, even pardoning people. I haven't seen the Times article, but I understand it's about how, despite all their experience in firefighting, almost none of the former inmates after they're out of prison are able to get jobs firefighting.
That's it.
And that's outrageous, too. These people have rehabilitated themselves in the most socially important and dramatic way. I mean, everybody talks about how firefighters are heroes and so on. They don't look closely at who's actually fighting the fires.
Yeah. And also, I mean, as you just said, you know, this also goes into this whole ban the box campaign and giving people a second chance. You have to say to these counties that whether or not people have felonies, they've got this experience and they want the job and they should be allowed to have it.
And in recognition of what they've done, particularly over the past 2 years, sentences should be reduced. I realize that this may factor a bit into parole hearings, but I think the governor should do something dramatic about it. He certainly could offer this as a last gesture because he's been very little involved in reducing super incarceration in California. So let him do something for these people.
Exactly. Well, Mike Davis, I want to thank you so much for taking the time today to talk to us. Mike's a rabble-rousing writer and urban theorist. We've been talking about A Tale of Two Fires. Mike became sort of infamous for his article in 1996 about the case for letting Malibu burn, and here it's literally amplified years later with these new firestorms. Mike Davis, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure always, Susie.
Thank you so much. Okay, and I'm Susie Wiseman. Don't go away.
Welcome back to Beneath the Surface. I'm producer-director Melissa Figueroa, sitting in for Susie Wiseman. As our hearts go out to everyone currently affected by the devastating fires in Los Angeles, we are digging into the archives to bring you the prescient wisdom of Mike Davis, who was a powerful voice speaking the truth about the science, history, and economics of California wildfires over the last three decades, and especially in the last years before his passing in 2022, spoke with clear-eyed prophetic vision about the impacts of climate change on a landscape dependent on fire and mismanaged by colonial capitalism. We now go to an interview from 2021 with Mike Davis, where we talk specifically about the implications of climate change for wildfires and their destructive power in the wildland-urban interface, and how the solution to this urgent problem and preventing further tragedy requires a radical decolonizing of the land, our cities, and ourselves. Here's Mike Davis from 2021.
I'm Susie Wiseman, here with you in the middle of, I guess, what we're going to call apocalyptic accelerationism, California's apocalyptic second nature. We're going to spend the hour talking about the fires, climate change, and everything that comes from this. We begin with Mike Davis. Mike has posted an article on the website Solidarity Above the Crisis, and he ends that article with these words: "A new, profoundly sinister nature is rapidly emerging from our fire rubble at the expense of landscapes we once considered sacred. Our imaginations can barely encompass the speed or scale of the catastrophe." And of course, he then says, "Gone, California, gone." Well, before we go into all of that, I must introduce Mike. He's, of course, a historian, activist, prolific author, and he's been writing about COVID and pandemics. And his new book there is The Monster Enters, COVID-19, Avian Flu, and the Plagues of Capitalism. And before that, Planet of Slums, Late Victorian Holocaust, Ecology of Fear, City of Quartz. There's a thread there. And I'm so glad that Mike is with us. And if we look at this, you know, apocalyptic situation that's literally engulfing Southern California, we see the signature, and everybody's seeing it across the world in the photographs, of these red and orange landscapes, or firescapes, I guess you could call them. So we're going to talk to Mike about what is the relationship of this accelerating apocalypse to climate change. And Mike, human behavior, of course, is what everyone says. It's pretty straightforward. And that's chiefly the burning of fossil fuels release greenhouse gases, and they increase temperatures, making for longer and hotter summers, and reducing rainfall, making for longer droughts. You've been writing about this for a long time, and plus creating desiccated forests that are primed to burn. So the bottom line of your article, Mike, that you posted essentially takes it from there. And you refer to Australia's Black Saturday forest fire in 2009, pretty apocalyptically, where you say that scientists calculate that the released energy equaled the explosion of 1,500 Hiroshima-sized bombs, and that these firestorms are many times larger. So how do we begin to understand these catastrophes? What is the situation?
Well, let me begin with a story. Three or four years ago, I wrote an article about the fires, and in the conclusion, I said that what was most disturbing of all the great fires that year, I think this was 2017, was the fact that Greenland was burning. There were wildfires in southern Greenland. This time around, and not to minimize the horror of the firestorms, the fire that riveted my attention and really sent chills up my back was the burning of the eastern Mojave. Now, on the way to Las Vegas, and if, unlike Hunter Thompson, you're not hallucinated, you'll pass an exit that says SEMA Road. It's a little two-lane blacktop, and it's the portal to one of the most magical forests on Earth, the largest and oldest Joshua Tree forest. You're talking about monarchs of Yucca, 50 feet tall, 1,000 years old, and I've been there dozens of times. They mantle a series of Pleistocene volcanoes, and it's just an incomparable place. Now, the eastern Mojave doesn't usually burn. It's covered with desert shrubs and smaller cactuses, open areas between them. But now it burns and will continue to burn, perhaps forever, because of the invasion of an exotic that is an alien imported grass called red brome. And it provides this continuous understory of fire starter, which now is rapidly reshaping desert ecosystems. And it's very unclear if the big Joshuas will ever reoccur, even if we wait 1,000 years. And that is really what the article is about. It's irreversible, permanent degradation of the landscapes we love so much throughout California, from the mixed pine and oak forests in the Klamath Mountains to the Mojave Desert, Sierra foothills. There's not an inch of California that is now not part of this conflagration. And it's true throughout the American West, of course.
But Mike, you're also talking about, I mean, I think this is, you know, worth it a moment to just dwell on the fact that these Joshua trees may be gone forever. And in this article, you actually go through and show how, you know, this was transformed, this fire ecology, as you're calling it, and that California is this paradigmatic example of this vicious circle where extreme heat leads to fires that prevent the natural rejuvenation and accelerate the conversion of these landscapes. And I found that incredibly interesting. And I want you to just go a little bit over the history of these changes and explain the way that land was changed through wars, as you say, all the way back to Berlin in World War II, after World War II, and then fires and climate change events.
Years ago, I got very interested in the science of dead cities, of cities that have been reduced to rubble by strategic bombing or destroyed by other events. And at the end of the Second World War, Berlin became an important scientific laboratory. So much of the city had been leveled and was sheer rubble. The natural sciences, even before the cleanup had begun, were studying the reaction of vegetation. And the expectation, according to the ruling theories of the time, is what you should see is the regeneration of the original national regional vegetation, mixed oak Pomeranian forest. That didn't happen. These studies continued until the last rubble and bomb landscape was finally removed in the 1980s. The original vegetation never came back. Started debate over something called Nature 2. What happened in Berlin is that the intense heat and the pulverization of brick structures changed the soil more or less permanently. And it was a bunch of escaped exotic plants from people's gardens and stuff that took over the bomb site, especially something called the Tree of Heaven. And these plants shared, as different as they were in terms of the families they belonged to, they shared a common adaptation. These are plants that had thrived on the terminal moraines of the great ice sheets in the Pleistocene. And they thrived on soils, stony soils, infertile soils. And this was quite a shock. And then that led the same scientists to speculate the nuclear winter might produce a similar kind of second nature over vast areas. Well, since the fires minus radiation are the equivalents of our nuclear winter, it's accelerated the conversion of landscapes. And what is the terminal state here? What is the destination of these changes? It's to create sinister-looking weed scrublands. In my favorite science fiction novel by the left-wing author Ward Moore, the book is called Greener Than You Think, and it's about this crazed scientist who develops something to promote the growth of people's lawns. Well, it promotes and never stops, and very soon Los Angeles is suffocated and devoured by the escaped grass. We're talking now about something similar, a weed apocalypse in California. And these plants, the bromes, including my favorite one, which is called ripgut, but there's ripbrome and other plants, cheatgrass, they thrive on fire. They also thrive on pollution. And after fire, they take over landscapes. They actually produce volatiles, toxics, that exclude other things. And formerly, this was considered a problem mainly in grasslands and then in the foothills. Now we're seeing in places like the coastal fir forests and in the Klamath Mountains that these now constitute somewhere between 7 and 20% of the land cover. I mean, this is a formula that will lead to us losing so much of California we love.
I need to ask a question that's probably it's an uneducated one, but you talk a lot about these alien grasses and trees that come in and shrubs that are part of the new sort of fire burning kinds of grasses. And I want to talk a little bit more about it, but where do they come from? Are they there that are normally suppressed by the original ecosystem, or does the wind blow them in? Do we know?
Yes, of course. First of all, they come like eucalyptus trees from other Mediterranean regions of the world, the classical Mediterranean, the Cape area, Western Australia, and Chile. And the Mediterranean landscapes, since the Columbian conquest and the development of world trade, have been constantly sending each other plants which thrive in similar climates, but can prove to be incredibly destructive, like eucalyptus, which is the kind of ultimate fire plant. Others were introduced as fodder for cattle. But the conversion of landscape by exotic weeds who then create or accelerate fire ecologies is an old story going back to the Spanish conquest of California. And some of the most iconic plants of the American West are actually recent imports. Think about tumbling tumbleweed. For instance, you hear Roy Rogers singing in the background. That's a Russian thistle, which has had a devastating impact in terms of fire throughout the Intermountain West. In California, we lost our beautiful native grasslands by the end of the 19th century due to overgrazing. And then, of course, in the 20th century, fire suppression has created monster fires that were extremely rare in the paleo climate record in California, because we did not allow fire-adapted trees like oaks and chaparral to rejuvenate themselves through fire. And you ended up with these immense acreages of unburnt, old, often biologically sterile plants just waiting to explode in fires. And when you have an extreme fire in a habitat where plants are fire-adapted, in fact, it thrived through small-scale burning, it can permanently change the balance of plants, the balance of soil chemicals. But above all, it's the frequency of large fires now. What were considered anomalous events in 2003, 2008 are now annual events. And I have a really horrifying example of all this not far from me. Cuyamaca State Park, my childhood, endless days spent hiking and fishing in the park, and it contains an unusual tree that it's the only location for this species. Now, it burned in the 2000s. It's never drawn back, despite heroic efforts by the park managers to replant pines and conifers. It's not recovered. What has flourished are these invasive grasses and shrubs. If anybody's wondering what these things look like, it's not a brome, but it's equally excellent fire starter. Every spring now, our hills eternally turn gold, bright yellow, okay? That's black mustard. It's spread absolutely everywhere. And once these take hold, they're almost ineradicable. What you need to do, burning, unless you do it every 6 months, doesn't really help because they're fire, you know, they live on fire. But if you weed them, you have to do it all the time to suppress them. They tried goats and cattle, but they're very ineffective and they don't like it. I mean, these are really kind of nightmare devil weed that has now become our constant companion in California.
Are these the same as the sweet mustard grasses that, say, you know, are all over the north along the Canadian border in Montana? In fact, we call it sweet grass.
Yeah, but I'm not sure those are flammable. There's, of course, always been fires on the grazing ranges of the West. But what's happened in the last generation in areas like the cold sage deserts of northern Nevada and Wyoming and now in the Mojave and even in the hot Sonora Desert is these grasses are bringing annual fire to deserts where plants are not fire adapted, like Joshua trees that have existed for 1,000 years. But they're everywhere, and their appearance in the forest and the significance in terms of combustion and fire is really only something people have recently grasped. I think that exurbanization is also the major ally of both weeds and fires, because everywhere you're building, almost two-thirds of homes built in California in the last generation have been built in high or extreme high fire risk areas. San Diego County has 60,000 homes already in the pipeline, built in, you know, the most flammable landscapes imaginable. But what happens then is through road building and land clearance, you make way for the weeds. People on their view lots worry about fire, so they clear all the chaparral or brush away. Then the grasses come, and they don't realize they've actually made their situation worse. This is what a botanical counter-revolution looks like.
Is this related, though, Mike? Because I was going to ask you about residential development, and I want to talk about the relationship between, you know, climate change and the drought, the hot droughts, the La Nina backdrop that you mentioned in your article. How do they relate to each other in terms of, you know, creating this firescape, essentially?
Well, whenever Governor Newsom or his predecessors talk about fire, they always strike a liberal line. Look, we didn't have these super fires before. This is climate change. We have to act now on climate. California's taken big steps in this direction. Okay, that's fine and good that we're acting to begin to solve a global problem. But what you do here and now about fire? Now, wildfire fighting is traditionally a kind of war maneuver, you know, where you maneuver around the fire. You set back fires. You know, you need a lot of space and a lot of mobility. But now that there are hundreds of thousands of homes in fire-prone areas, there's enormous pressure to defend house by house. And this has led to increasing deaths and casualties amongst fire crews. It's made firefighting much more dangerous than it was before. What can you do about this? Well, I think two things need to be done. And the first and most important is simply to impose a moratorium on new construction in the backcountry, in the forest, in the foothills. Stop it now and then begin to think about how to, if possible, roll back some of the existing development. But it's just absolutely idiotic to continue development. But it's politically an issue that nobody really wants to touch, except for a few brave environmental souls, because the populations in the exurban Sierra foothill counties and in Southern California, the last thing they will do is vote for a politician who talks about stopping growth. And of course, real estate development industry is the most powerful single organized political force in California.
Right. And the kinds of mistaken land management and fire management practices that you wrote about and almost got lynched for decades ago, I think it was, Mike, when you said, let Malibu burn. And now you say, even in this article, that Malibu's on a sort of predictable cycle, right?
Malibu's an example that because of its topography, the orientation of its steep canyon to the direction of Santa Ana winds, and because of its vegetation, simply burns almost as much as possible. That's why you have a few examples of homeowners who've lost their homes 3 times in the Santa Monica's. You shouldn't build there. It should be a great state park. But unfortunately, more and more parts of California are becoming like Malibu, And the only real control or restraint on fire is simply biomass, fuel. If you burn enough of it, perhaps you won't get super fires. You could also pave the entire state. That would solve the problem too. But fires appearing in all kinds of places where it was never expected to happen. The burning of a large part of suburban Santa Rosa a few years ago. This was not in the mountains or the foothills. This is just a flat residential area in a medium-sized California city. And it was burnt to ash by an escape fire. Nobody is really safe now in California. And that's why it's so urgent. And this can only come from environmentalists, Native California activists, and from the left, is to focus on this question of uncontrolled real estate development and begin to develop an understanding of the task ahead. The Green New Deal in California, it seems to me, should be, first of all, a jobs program, because we need 100,000 kids and people, not slave-like convicts who are forced to fight these fires for a dollar an hour, up there trying to control the weeds, trying to clear underbrush. But this has to be almost a matter of landscape gardening. It has to go on constantly because these plants are so devilish in their ability, you know, to regrow and thrive. I think one of the simple things we should be fighting for, the compulsory half year on California natural history and Native California. My kids, you know, apart from me taking them out to the mountains where I grew up, they've learned nothing in school. They can't tell a single piece of native vegetation. They don't understand the fires. And I can't understand why this hasn't become a priority. Something teachers' unions should advocate. So the left really needs to build an alliance on this issue. Yes, we must act on climate change, but in California, we want to keep what's at the core of our identity and in our hearts. We need to look at the here and now steps.
Well, yeah, that's kind of apocalyptic. And I know I posted your article last night and somebody said that this is apocalyptic accelerationism, which I started with. And it does seem like there's a confluence of so many different apocalypses right now, political, ecological, fire, weather, all of it, that it's stunning.
Well, let me refer to apocalypse and its actual meaning in the book of Revelations. The apocalypse is the unveiling of the true history of the world, not the history written by victors and owners, but the history that's been lived by common people itself. And what's been happening and what's happening on this program right now is starting to retrieve some of that hidden knowledge of the fact that capitalist civilization, white capitalist civilization in California, has been mining and never ceased to mine the natural resources of this state, have just destabilized its ecosystems and have created a corridor for climate change and fire to transform large parts of California into something unrecognizable to us. Also, I wanted to make the point that it's not traditional communities in Northern California or the Sierras. It's not poor people living in some cabins with the problem. But the majority of the homes that have been built in high fire hazard areas are in fact homes for relatively wealthy people or more. For instance, here in San Diego, my literary agent has a huge art gallery, a personal art collection, but her home in Del Mar is too small to accommodate it. And to add on to it would be prohibitively expensive. I'm talking about millions of dollars. But for $600,000, you can go up the mountains and buy a home twice as large with a magnificent view in the middle of a forest that's burned twice in the last 20 years. It's people.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, and Yes, you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio for all of Southern California. And normally we would have Sylvester Rivers with Cut to the Chase. He has now moved to Fridays at 7 a.m. So note that, mark that. Sylvester Rivers' Cut to the Chase will be now on Fridays at 7 a.m. All right, we're going to continue with fire coverage later on in the day. You can get your update at 12 noon. And right now we are going to play Ian Masters' Background Briefing right here on KPFK.